There's one thing we could do that would fix everything for us.
What? Pray for something to happen to Nick?
Something like that.
Cora.
Well, you suggested it yourself once, didn't you?
I was only joking.
Were you?
Yes, I was.
Or had you started to think about it a little?
Maybe I said it, but I didn't really mean it.
Well, I say it again now, and I do mean it. Frank, listen to me. I'm not what you think I am. I've made a big mistake in my life, and I've got to be this way just once to fix it.
They hang you for a thing like that.
Oh, but not if you do it right. And you're smart, Frank. You'll think of a way. Plenty of men have.
He never did any harm to me.
But darling, can't you see how happy you and I would be together here without him?
Ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez.
I'm Drea Clark.
And I'm Samantha Ellis.
We are celebrating all things John Garfield.
Yay!
I'm excited. I don't know about the rest of you.
I'm very excited.
We are talking about the 1946 film noir, The Postman Always Rings Twice. The best way is to talk about John Garfield before this, since this is our episode devoted to him. I think I've told the story before on this podcast. If I haven't and you're new, then I'm going to tell the story again. So I pretty much decided that I would invent a time machine to go back and save John Garfield from dying at 39. After last year's TCM Classic Film Festival, I went with a friend. We went to go see The Seawolf because Ida Lupino was in it. And at the time, I didn't know it, but I was in the throes of a very bad cold. And I had a fever. I felt terrible. At a certain point, John Garfield comes out in The Seawolf, and I looked up, and it was fireworks were going all around. That could have been the delirium from the fact that I was violently ill and I did not know it. But at the time, I was clammy hands. I'm sweaty. It must be love. And that hasn't gone away. Actually got
that's first. Both endearing and horrifying. All good love stories.
Of course. It all starts with being violently ill and you're like, is it love or is it just the flu? I don't know. I've seen several movies, some good, some bad, some why is this a thing? And I've read one biography. I have one more I have to read. I think it's obsession. Yeah, I think as much obsession as you can be with a person who's been dead for 60 years. Where do you ladies stand on John Garfield before we talk about this movie? What's your background with everybody? We'll start with Drea.
Honestly, I think you have infected me to a certain degree.
That happens.
Also, maybe the flu, maybe love. Obviously, I've seen this film before, with more of a critical eye towards analysis and digging in, because I had seen an adaptation of it before I saw the original. And so I was looking more for how is this different and how are they playing things? And this time I for sure had my Garfield goggles on and was like, what is it? What is it that's setting this off in Kristen? And I did get it. I really was like, oh, he's got a very grounded, earthy smirkiness to him.
My mother says I have a type, and I kind of agree with her based on a lot of the John Garfield movies that I've seen.
You definitely have a type. I appreciated him. It's hard because it's one of those things. I think Lana Turner is so gorgeous and otherworldly in this. I don't know who could be paired with her that would make sense, because she's meant to stand out so much. She doesn't really even look human at times. She's pristine and goddess-like. And he is this earthy male. And actually, this time, it made sense to me. I was like, oh, yeah, no, I get it. He's got a carnalness to him that works.
It all just sounds dirty, and I love it.
It does.
Samantha, what about you? What was your history before this?
I definitely learned about him in relation to a lot of the other method actors of the time. I really give my hat off to him because he was the first of those, like you said, carnal, earthy method actors. Of course, you know, who would follow would be the Montgomery Clifts, the Marlon Brandos, the James Deans. But John Garfield was really first, and I feel like he doesn't get enough credit for that. I've seen quite a few of his films, actually. I've seen this, of course, like everybody. I've seen him in Humoresque, and I adore him in He Ran All the Way. But I always want to see more movies of his because every single performance that I see of his tops the last. He's such a good actor. I've been going into this a really big fan already.
I know I surprised Samantha when I told her that I actually saw this very late in my John Garfield film binge. I had seen several other movies before I even got to this. Yet this is considered his most famous role. I watched The Seawolf first, and then I saw like Four Daughters, and that's still my favorite. Four Daughters is his best. Don't at me. It's true.
I think everybody who has their number one favorite prefers movies that aren't considered their greatest. I don't think I've ever seen a Ginger Rogers fan that loves her with Fred Astaire more than anybody else. There's always that one like, oh, she's so great in Kitty Foyle. I'm a Tyrone Power fan. His most famous would be The Mark of Zorro. That's another one I saw really late into my love of him. And my favorite of his is Love is News, which is not on anybody's radar. So I totally feel you for that.
Mine is Gentleman's Agreement because of his proximity to my boyfriend, Gregory Peck.
It's a weird thing. I always have this noirish connection to things because I saw Gentleman's Agreement maybe about 6 years ago. And I actually have at least two reviews of John Garfield movies that I saw. Gentleman's Agreement and Destination Tokyo. And I just said, he's fine. He's okay.
Oh, no.
I do that a lot. Ask my mom about the ways to talk about Oscar Isaac. I bet on the wrong ponies. And then I come back around. It's really interesting that Postman is the film that he's famous for because it came fairly late in his career. He started out as Samantha said, one of the early proponents of the method, because he spent a lot of time doing stage work, a lot like Montgomery Clift. Montgomery Clift was really hesitant to go to Hollywood and make movies because that was considered selling out. If you were a stage actor, you were serious and gritty and you weren't going to get quality making movies. And so John Garfield, who started out life as Julius Garfinkel, they made him change his name because it wasn't marquee worthy. Started out working with the New York theater scene and the group theater and all of that, Clifford Odets, and eventually went to Hollywood and worked for Warners. But he was really not into making movies because he wanted clauses in his contract to be able to do stage work. He felt that a lot of the movies that he was making were really terrible. And I find that to be very funny because he does stick out in certain movies. The aforementioned Four Daughters is a delightful film that he just shows up and he wears black a lot and talks about how everything sucks. You're just like, aw, you're the little black rain cloud that just constantly reminds people about how horrible the world is. I love
it. He's the Eeyore of the film.
He is the Eeyore of the film. And I think that that really limited him almost. I mean, he made several romantic dramas, but he always felt very different and not at all like what was being perceived, not just looks wise, but acting wise, what was being perceived on the screen. I'm pretty sure that had he lived and time being what it is, and I get that time machine going, it would be a toxic relationship because like all his characters are vaguely toxic people, but they're endearing at the same time. Before we get into talking about Postman, communism killed him.
I totally agree with that.
I appreciate any statement as bold as communism killed him.
Anytime somebody asks me, well, you know, how did he die at 39? I'm like, communism. John Garfield was a serious liberal, and he got wrapped up in the communist issues of the 40s and the 50s. I mean, he had joined the Committee for the First Amendment, which was a group of people that were against the government investigating people's political beliefs. There were stories about his wife being involved in communist activities, but there's never been anything proven that he was involved. And so he got called to testify before HUAC. He refused to name names because Hollywood was stupid back then. They decided that anybody who was not going to name other people could not work in Hollywood anymore. He effectively was blackballed. Towards the end of his life, there was a lot of personal issues. He ended up getting separated from his wife, but he wanted to work again. He had to self-finance movies, and he couldn't get the movies that he wanted made. So he was going to go back and testify before HUAC. And then he ended up suffering from a heart attack and died. There is a very salacious story behind all of that, which you are welcome to Google. I will not respond to it because of personal reasons. Yes, he had a weak heart, but I believe that the stress of communism and having to deal with HUAC and all the personal stuff is what contributed. Communism is bad, but HUAC is worse. Just remember that.
I think history would agree. And I think it actually ties into the kind of artist he was. The method approach to acting is so all-consuming that the people who gravitate towards it tend to be people who wear their emotions very close to the surface. Marlon Brando was a much slower decay. It's an interesting thing how artistic approach can affect people's well-being. And it would make sense if being totally blacklisted and denied that outlet could just exacerbate things.
That's very true. I feel like a lot of the method actors burned out very quickly.
The fact that they have to give so much of themselves, too. Absolutely. I mean, I think that that plays into it. He ended up dying in 52, which is very, very sad, because to just imagine the films that could have been had he lived into old age. You watch something like On the Waterfront. My Leonard Bernstein episode, we talked about On the Waterfront, and I mentioned in that episode that Marlon Brando got the role because John Garfield died. He was supposed to be the lead in that movie. I always get very upset watching On the Waterfront because I find that movie's okay, and I probably would like it more if it had John Garfield in it. I can see where he would have been great.
Oh, that's so sad. I actually didn't know that, but now that you mention it, I wholeheartedly agree.
I've actually read a theory that the Heber Marie Saint's brother who dies in the beginning, so it's not really a spoiler, who is killed at the beginning of the movie, that essentially is what the plot revolves around, is supposed to be a stand-in for John Garfield, the character killed by this mob mentality and has to be avenged. So I find that movie to be very cool on an analytical, symbolic level, but I always get very miffed. So that brings us to Postman, directed by Tay Garnett, written by Harry Ruskin and Niven Bush off of the novel by James M. Cain, who you might know is the author of Mildred Pierce. It stars Lana Turner, the aforementioned John Garfield, Cecil Calloway, Hume Cronin, and Leon Ames, the dad from Meet Me in St. Louis, who I feel we just talked about. Didn't we talk about a movie, Sam, that he was in?
We did.
We did. I don't remember what it was.
That's a very good point. I really like him. I was going to talk about him, too.
We will bring him up when time comes. It tells the story of Frank Chambers, played by John Garfield, who is this restless drifter. Remember the days when drifters dressed in nice suits and were hot, saucy, looked like John Garfield? I don't remember those days, but apparently they existed, at least in Hollywood.
Those were the same days where a sign that said men wanted was appropriate and viewable from the highway.
Where you could just put a sign up that said man wanted and somebody understood immediately what you were and weren't asking for. Just saying. So he is a drifter who brings up the fact that his feet are always itching to move somewhere, implying the noirish tradition that men can't be controlled by mere things like free will. There's always a grander scheme that brings them into trouble. He ends up at the Twin Oaks Cafe run by Cora and Nick Smith, played by Lana Turner and Cecil Calloway. And if you're saying, hey, Cecil Calloway, the old guy who played Veronica Lake's dad in I Married a Witch, yep, that's the relationship you're working with here. So Cora is the bright young wife who wants to turn Twin Oaks into something. She wants to make it a legit restaurant. Cecil Calloway's Nick is just kind of a layabout. He doesn't really care. He wants to save money, but he doesn't really want to spend money to make it a better place. Saucy affairs ensue between Frank and Cora, and it turns into good old-fashioned murder with them deciding, you know, maybe we should kill Nick because he's kind of boring. He doesn't want to do anything special. I've seen this movie 3 times now. Still don't think it's my favorite noir. I think a lot of that has to do with Tay Garnett as the director. He was not, again, necessarily known as being a noir director. He was more of a journeyman. He started out working with Max Sennett, made a lot of movies. He's a director who did several things, but was never really known for being a director of hard-boiled stuff. And I think that that's probably my problem with it, is that just when it does want to be serious, it kind of takes this turn into melodrama. But there is a lot of great symbolism in this movie. We have a femme fatale who doesn't want to be a femme fatale, and the movie keeps trying to make her one. She resists throughout the whole film. Sam, what did you think about this movie? What's been your background with it before we talked about it today?
I've actually seen it countless times. Funny enough, my boyfriend did not want me to watch this again to review the film because he told me, you've seen this so many times. You know this movie back and forth in your sleep. But I still said, no, I want to watch it again because I really do love it so much. I know you say it's not one of your favorite noirs, but I would definitely say it's one of mine because romance is definitely my favorite genre. And this movie really works the romance and the tension into the story. I already love noir. I already love romance. So it really works for me. This is actually a movie, too, that inspired me to read the original book that it was based on. And I was surprised when I read the book that in the novel, Nick is essentially a Greek stereotype. They're all pretty different from the way that they're portrayed in the film. Cora is this dark-haired, ethnic firecracker, and Frank is this sardonic blonde. And if I could recast the two leads according to the book, I probably would have cast William Holden as Frank, even though he would have been a little young, and Yvonne DiCarlo as Cora. But I still love the changes that were made in this film. I love Lana. I love John Garfield. I don't love Cecil Calloway, but I think it works because they want to kill him anyway. I really love this film. I couldn't really say too many bad things about it.
I would agree that the romance is the highlight of it. The two of them are a perfect example of when chemistry works. The leads have chemistry or they don't. It's not a tangible quality. But these two are very crackle, and you very much, from the first second they see each other, are like, oh yeah, they want it. And that makes all the sense in the world. So the romance of it is spot on. It's interesting that you've read the James M. Cain book it's based on, because one of my problems, I agree that the directing's a little tonally all over, and even the character of Nick is a perfect example of that. When he first comes out, if I had never seen this before, I would be like, oh, is that the simple man that lives with them and does heavy lifting? Like, he looks like George from Of Mice and Men. It's insane. He's like, oh, hello, come, let me get your bag. It's very weird. And then you're like, oh, no, that's the owner and the husband. Weird. The other thing about this as a noir that's tricky is the romance is spot on. So that has some tension of the like, oh, they need to leave him and they're having this affair. But the structure of this thing is bonkers. Normally, the film noir structure is you're in the heat of it the whole time. This has an aborted murder attempt. They're going to try and kill him once, and it's thwarted and goes wrong because of a cat, which, again, plot twist I'm in favor of. I think cats should be involved in a lot more narrative construction. That's just something I feel strongly about. That's sort of midway through the first time they try and kill him. And then he makes it. And there's a court case in it that's so strange to me. It's a weird structure for something if you're looking at it as a noir. As a more inventive drama, it's kind of intriguing to take all those things on. This is always going to be an enjoyable watch for me because of the chemistry. I think that supersedes any of the sort of messy story threads that come up.
Well, you bring up the bonkers plot trajectory, which is true. This is a movie that, well, they did remake it 20 years later. They remade it in the 80s, and they turned it into neo-noir in the vein of there was a string of movies that were taking noirish topics and just infusing them with a lot of sex. that you didn't necessarily need. Full disclosure, I have not seen the remake with Jessica Lange and Jack Nicholson, and I'm not really into seeing it. I can see where adding more sex to this movie might be seen as progressive, but it's a very, very sexy movie without having to show anything. But it does start with these two characters hating each other and then realizing that I never understand that they love each other. I think that they just enjoy screwing each other. Sometimes that can make up for a lack of cool love. They conjure up this murder plot very quickly, and it doesn't work. They're already suspected to the murder plot, and it works. And then they get married, and then almost immediately after saying I do, they hate each other again. And then it's like, end movie. So I feel like this is a film that feels very lengthy at 2 hours, but it's because the script really doesn't seem to know what these two characters want. And maybe that's the point. Maybe they don't know what they want.
Oh, no, you're not alone. Part of the issue is all of the curves of this story take hits at what these characters are. I believed that the two of them were both attracted and then eventually in love with each other. They had a connection and also saw that unimaginable future with each other. Like, oh, he's this guy, he's been transient, he's never put in roots, and here's this woman who's ambitious and wants to grow this place and already has this place. I saw that as a very tantalizing and interesting thing for them to go after. It's not like, oh, I want to kill my millionaire husband to travel the world. Like, no, I'd like to run a very simple family restaurant along the highway. I believed their love, and that not just because of each other, but also the futures they were envisioning. But the thing that you're going back and forth with, the whole swell of the ending is the irony of, oh, they did love each other and they did come back together, and then fate punishes them anyway, would have felt more significant to me if they go through like 15 different times of trusting and not trusting. And if we want to talk about Hume Cronyn for 30 minutes, because he's of course my favorite part of the film, as he was also my favorite part of Shadow of a Doubt, I'm well willing to do that. He orchestrates this whole thing where they turn on each other, and I felt like all of the story twists made it impossible to always be tracking or then invested in what their characters were feeling.
It's a bit of an anti-noir because this is a movie that really looks at the noirish elements and goes really bleak with them. So we start out with Frank going through the motions of being a typical noir protagonist. You know, again, his feet take him. They deliver him to the Twin Oaks as if he's compelled by God's will to go there. And at the same time, he immediately is a terrible character because he shows up, he meets Nick, they have this nice little back and forth, and then Cora shows up and she just does not have any interest for him. He's the one pursuing her. So you don't have this noirish idea like in something like Double Indemnity, where Barbara Stanwyck shows up on the top of the stairs in a towel and the conceit is that she's nude because she's been sunbathing, tempting the protagonist. No, this is a guy that, for lack of a better word, is compelled to do things because of his dick. I find that to be very funny because every bad decision he makes in this movie is based in some form off of sex, whether it's pursuing Cora, whether it's trying to leave the Twin Oaks and start over, whether it's to immediately go to Mexico with Audrey Totter. I mean, it's Audrey Totter, so I understand it, but it's not really a good look. The movie almost seems to make fun of him because of just how dumb his motivations are. I like that. I like that he's not this incredibly smart character who has a good job. I mean, I think it's also worth pointing out that most noirish leading men have jobs, whether it's Sam Spade being a PI, Walter Neff being an insurance investigator. Frank doesn't even have a job. He's a bum. I like that the movie decides, you know what? We're just going to make him this messy leading man who in any other movie would not be able to pull things off. And you know what? At the end of the movie, he doesn't. Not just because of plot conventions involving the Hayes office, but just because he's dumb.
I'm proud of you for calling him dumb. A bold and unexpected choice. I'm hoping I'm not being too critical because I do have such fondness for this film. But my fondness is almost in spite of the story because I think it's all over.
No, you're right. I think this is a movie that you will critique. If you've seen so many noirs, it can't help but look like a mess. So no, critique away.
Sam, did you have similar or any thoughts about like the story structure? Did they stand in the way of how you saw the characters or did it not affect you?
I would say that it didn't affect me because I know this sounds terrible compared to your guys' critiques, but to me, it's one of those couples that ultimately always comes back to each other. That is so important. It's a common theme in noir, but not to this degree. Of course, you have the couples that are willing to kill for each other, but if you compare this to something like Double Indemnity, Walter Neff, as soon as he realizes that he could get off scot-free, he does, or he tries to. John Garfield definitely is not that way in this, because by that point, he cares for Cora immensely. And I think that is something that really should be looked at and almost to distract from the actual issues in the plot. It definitely distracts me. This is just one of those movies that I enjoy. When I see a couple that I root for this much, nothing else matters. And that really sticks here for me.
Samantha is the hopeless romantic, and I'm just the person that spouted out, he follows his dick throughout 2 hours.
But the thing is, if he was only following his dick, he is so hesitant in the beginning of the film. Just in general, he knows that approaching her is wrong. He feels like Nick is a fine guy. But even by the time that they make the decision, yes, we're going to kill him, I think he's already in over his head with her.
I read him completely different in the beginning of this movie.
Especially towards the end, when they find out that she's pregnant. It's obvious that, as you guys said, they have so many different motivations. They trust each other and don't trust each other. But that whole time, after she reveals that she's having his baby, they are devoted to each other and they all have one goal. And I think that's what makes it so tragic, because now that they're finally on the same page, now that they know what they want to do and that they're able to do it now, it all falls apart after Cora dies.
I'll break down my thought process. So in the beginning, when you get that famous shot of Lana Turner with the camera starting at her legs and going up and she's all in white, the camera is from his viewpoint. So you get this lasciviousness a little bit. And then
sure,
when he picks up the lipstick and he won't hand it to her, which, by the way, that's a Garfield move. He does that in all his movies. And I was just like, dude, that was shtick. Like, you did that off screen. And you know what? I'm okay with it. Lighting the match, too, is also his thing. He does that a lot.
I was actually going to bring that up because I watched this movie again, obviously, after we recorded the couples episode. And I finally realized that. I've seen this movie so many times, but I finally caught on to that lighting of the match. I think that scene speaks volumes because it's so subtle, where Turner pulls out her cigarette and Garfield effortlessly lights that match with the flick of his thumb. But Turner's so stubborn and she wants that independence that she tries again and again to furiously strike her own match before she eventually is like, okay, you can light my cigarette.
There is so much thirst imagery in this movie. And that's one of them.
It's very true. I loved that subtlety and that symbolism.
There's so much raging heat in this movie. Burnt hamburgers. There's a dead cat. Some of the symbolism is actually pretty smutty if you really think about it. He really wants her. He might not express it in the beginning, but the intent is that, like, he's super thirst. Like, the thirst level is off the charts. The dancing sequence when she's like, I'll dance with Nick, and he's like, well, I'll dance with you. Like, dude, put a Bible between you and the Lord, because I'm very concerned. There's definitely this pursuit that comes more from him than from her, because she understands what is going to happen because she's smarter than him. But at a certain point in the narrative, you brought up this whole element of trust. It becomes this competition between the two of them to decide who is more trustworthy. I do think that there is more of a lustful air. And you read him as this guy who, once he's married, once domesticity has shackled him, which again might be because I've seen a lot of John Garfield movies and that seems to be a thing, he resists it. But then when there's the baby and he can't escape it, he's like, oh, I guess I'll have to make a go of it. And then the ending happens, which we'll talk about the ending. Depending on how you want to read it, it's almost like domesticity and murder, like the two deaths of the American male. So I do read it a bit more nihilistic, but I don't necessarily think either version is wrong. So I love, Sam, that you see it a bit more romantically than I do.
I think at the end of the day, what is the definition of love when you're willing to give up everything, including your life, for that other person? It's dark, but that it's interesting at the same time. And I think that could be a representation of their very unique love story.
Drea, who's right?
We're disagreeing again.
No, I'm sure some middle distance that I believe is true is what's right. And not either of you. I'm just kidding. It's interesting because the choices made around these characters, and I love Kristen bringing up the great imagery. And actually, Sam, you brought up all of the symbolism too, that there is so much of that baked into the direction. It's one of those films, I think, one of the reasons the people who love it can love it so fully, and the people who question it have plenty of evidence. The direction feels like it just went scene by scene rather than a cohesive through line. Because how they are within each individual scene doesn't always feel like it translates to the next time we see them on screen. Nick is a great example of this. When you first see him, he's bumbling and honestly simple. He's got a very simple vibe. And also, I do want to make sure I add, this film always makes me revisit why I don't have more white in my wardrobe, because obviously that's a look we should all be going for. But when we see her, she's very clinical and very goddess-like and untouchable and pristine. There's a variance in how people appear scene to scene. Part of that, like when you're in those scenes, they're just giving it their all. But it's also, there's a disconnect, and it adds to the elements of this that I find so implausible. Like the dancing scene that you're talking about. On paper, I can say, oh, sure, I can see a version of the scene where the husband is like not looking up from his guitar. But I just remember every time I watch this and the second they start dancing, my two simultaneous thoughts are, oh, those two are so hot and I love it. And also, this would never happen. You would never make unbroken eye contact like that with someone else's wife or with another man with the husband there. So it's that kind of disconnect for it. So what I'm saying is you're both right.
I am perfectly willing to accept that there are flaws in this movie. And I actually think that that's a fantastic point, that one of the biggest flaws is that it does seem like each scene is shot separately. One of the greatest things about it, though, you could argue, is that each of those scenes is so good, even if they don't make one cohesive plot. And it is so much back and forth, but at the same time, that's Frank's character. He's always so unsure from the first thing. He doesn't know what he wants. Cora always does, but she's also having to deal with his indecisiveness.
You brought up too, Drea, the relationship that Nick has with Cora and his character. And I think watching it this go round, Cecil Kellaway is very interesting. And I think that the movie almost makes an assertion by not making an assertion at all. There's a little bit of knowledge on Nick's part that he knows what's going on. And it's almost to throw in a really snooty literary reference. It's almost like a Lady Chatterley thing. If anybody's read
I've read it.
Lawrence, I don't recommend it if you want to stay positive. Lady Chatterley is the story of a woman who is young and hot, who is married to a man who paralyzed and can't consummate the marriage. And so she essentially goes out and has this torrid affair with the gameskeeper. It's this nature of discretion that she should be having an affair, but it should be with someone of her station. And I get that with Postman, that Nick realizes that he is older and that his wife is young and beautiful. There's a little bit of encouragement by him. The fact that that dancing sequence exists and he is totally okay with his wife dancing with this guy who is closer in age to her, who's hot as hell. He says hi, but I think the implication is drunk. That he's constantly drinking, almost as if to compensate for the fact that he probably knows what his wife is thinking. Mind you, I don't think he knows if she's acting on it, but I do think there is that tacit, like, okay, I'm not going to comment on it, but I'm also not going to condemn it either.
So in this reading, do you think Nick was complicit in knowing that his wife would likely have an affair?
I do, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Before he watches them dance, he's also sung this little song about how lucky he is because he has a wife who loves him. He's not coming out of this place of desperation, but that's the kind of thing that would fuel that decision. So it's a very interesting for him to grab on to Garfield, like when he shows up with his man wanted sign and he like literally runs out to drag him into the home. And then he's the one, once John Garfield tries to do the noble thing and gets out of Dodge and is like, all right, I'm going to leave. But then he goes back to the docks in Los Angeles just to try and spy on her. And Nick finds him there and literally brings him back into his home. I could probably be swayed into thinking Nick was making it happen to keep his wife happy.
I'm not fully on that bandwagon per se, but I do think that an argument could be made for that, especially because it's part of Nick's character. I think he's very happy-go-lucky, very go-with-the-flow. He understands that his wife is young and still wants to have fun. He loves Frank, too. He thinks he's a great guy, so he's going to let them have fun. But I think when it really came down to it, he would be upset if he was made fully aware that there was an affair going on. Maybe you could even argue he's too simple to understand the full extent of their relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been prone to looking at more that he is somehow just oblivious to a level beyond time and space. Because if he was complicit, then it sort of negates the point of them needing to off him.
I thought the same thing.
I think he'd have been okay if it was just sex. And notice how after they declare their love for each other, that he comes up with the idea of, well, we need to move to go live with my invalid sister that I never told you about, Cora, in all these years that we've been married. Once he realizes that there's love between the two of them and that he's going to lose her, then the tide turns. If it was just sins of the flesh type of thing that he can't provide, then it's totally okay. Again, we're reading far more into this movie. There's no right or wrong answer, but I think that that's how this movie works. Andrea, you bring up the fact that the murder comes out of nowhere, and I think that that leads to my biggest issue with this movie, which is Cora Smith, reluctant femme fatale. Lana Turner was never really... Nell Manow said it about Rita Hayworth when we did the Lady from Shanghai episode. Lana Turner, to me, was never an actress. She was always a celebrity. I don't think she never got the chance to really show her acting, because when you have a face like that, how can you? And here, what I love about Cora Smith as a character is that she starts out this movie with a simple goal in mind. She wants to turn this restaurant into something. People assume, based on how she looks, that she is cheap. Notice how she gets really defensive when Frank is talking about he's going to go look for cheap paint, I think it is. And she's like, you won't find anything cheap around here. She's very defensive about how people perceive her. And I think that's because people assume, looking at her relationship and looking at her, that she is a gold digger, that she is a certain way. And much of what she has for the first, like, 40 minutes of this movie is very anti-femme fatale. She genuinely seems to care for her husband. She wants to be a businesswoman. out of nowhere in the middle of this movie, she's just like, I think we should kill my husband. Because I almost feels like the script demands that she be evil. The screenwriters don't really know how to make that short of just like kicking her into that role. But even once they do turn to murder, she still has the sympathy for me, at least. She immediately goes back to her goal, which is she wants to turn the restaurant into something. She gets married to Frank, and this domesticity, getting what you want, essentially, is what turns them against each other. But even then, she has valid reasons to hate him. He's going off to Mexico and cheating on her. She's pregnant. She's got all these things heaped upon her. And then the movie kills her. We all know why she dies, because she's evil. But I also think she dies because she's a woman that aspires too high for 1940s.
Kristen, she dies because the postman always rings twice.
That's very true, but she dies because she's a woman. There's something to be said about watching this alongside something like Leave Her to Heaven, where you have these two very strong-willed women who are married to dumb guys. One's a bit more dumber than the other. Cornell Wilde, you know what you did. At least in Leave Her to Heaven, she takes the action into her own hands, whereas Cora just wants to be a businesswoman and be happy, and everybody else wants her to do what they want. Frank wants her to be a sex object. Nick wants her to go take care of his invalid sister that he never told her about. I can't get over that. How do you marry somebody and then say, oh, by the way, I have family. I just never mentioned it to you. But she is compelled by men to go be what they want, to go do what they want her to do.
I would actually argue that her death is a niceness that's been done to her by the author.
Ooh, okay.
I mean, she's a murderess. She killed her husband out of greed and ambition. She took a human life. And the way that her life ends in it is she is punished by fate, but she dies feeling loved. She dies having her love and her dreams, that all of those have come correct, that she knows that Garfield trusts her and that she can now trust him. And it's nipped in the bud. She doesn't have her reputation ruined. It's not public. And also, what he's in jail for and convicted of is the murder of her, never the murder of Nick. When he sort of succumbs to it, it's because he knows he deserves it for Nick. But that means he dies branded as a murderer. She does not. She dies as a victim.
That's a very good point. She's spared the humiliation of the trial and getting branded as something that she doesn't want, getting branded as a woman who kills for ambition, the gold digger image that she never wanted.
I do want to talk about some of the imagery. We've talked about some of the symbolism in this movie. And what I really love is the cat. The murder the first time is ruined by a cat that ends up being killed. Justice for that cat.
Dead as a doornail?
Dead as a doornail. Cat jumped out on a live wire. You can read it as the cat represents Frank. You could go with the more male-based ending, which is that the cat symbolizes Cora for various reasons. But all of it leads to this concept of their horniness is what stopped everything. And they go back to that cat numerous times. I just love how this movie slips in really interesting symbols.
Well, I obviously am with you on the justice for the cat front. I would also add, I think the cat was set up. There's no way a cat is dumb enough to wander on to a live wire, and I call shenanigans. The smoking gun of this film is a smoking feline is kind of amazing, and that they show it to us. And then it's also the perfect pathway into realizing that the cop is, in fact, the most simple man amongst them. What a sweet dum-dum.
I love that there's like a random police officer who should be looking into a possible murder, and instead all he can focus on is this poor cat. I think it's really cute to have like this tough male police officer who is a cat lover. It's interesting.
I know we brought up side characters, and I know Drea talked about Hume Cronin.
Not nearly enough. I did not talk about Hume Cronyn.
We are talking nearly about enough. Hume Cronyn. Hume Cronyn plays Cora's attorney, Arthur Keats. He steals a lot of the third act for this movie. He plays this slimy lawyer who understands exactly how these two characters are going to act. He knows exactly what's going to happen between Cora and Frank and plans for every eventuality. So when Frank ends up rolling on Cora, Cora decides in a fit of anger that she's going to confess. She actually writes out a confession, which ends up going back to Keats because he's a smart guy and he knows that these are two people pulled by their genitals. And I think that he is a delight in this movie.
He's always
so good. He sure is. I would honestly say, too, I know, Kristen, you and I always are the ones to point out the gay context in this. Are the two lawyers a little close for comfort, or am I reading into this too much?
I put Keats in the vein of Martin Landau's character in North by Northwest.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
They're both creepy, effete men who you can't help but read as gay stereotypes.
As a full-blooded American woman who lusted heavily after Hume Cronyn in this film, how dare you? How dare you, ma'am? I do think there's something to the winkingness of it, and I would certainly be thrilled if he was a gay man that was nicely getting it off with the other only intelligent person in this world. But what I liked about Keats is also something that is one of those paths the film took that took me out of it a little, which is he is so much spark and there's so much story going on. There's subterfuge. The lawyer's pulling something over. She's confessing, but it's fake. There's all of these things. And then they show up again. This is a film whose strength is in this male-female sexy relationship. I don't think it could handle the bombast appearance of a intellectual Hume Cronyn. The whole section to me, I honestly, if I was adapting this, would have trimmed out. I would have gotten rid of like the first death. And then this isn't on the supporting characters, which I'm sure Kristen has some others to bring up. But my other story qualm of this is it is 100% nonsense that the district attorney who happens to live down the road would be as invested in looking for murder as he is. It's nonsense. There's the smoking gun cat. It is very clear the first attempt on his life, they have nothing to do with it that he knows about. And so the idea that there would have been a car accident, that there's immediately a police presence there. Sure. Nonsense. Okay, I'm done.
I always notice in movies when they use words in a different context. And so he says dick a lot in this movie. And I was just like, he's referring to private detective, but I was just like, oh, wow. I always forget that in certain movies.
I didn't even notice that.
He says at a certain point, when they're all something, they thought he was a detective. He saw something, he was a dick, but he's not a dick anymore. And I was just like, aw, those days when that meant something different.
Oh my goodness. I have to say, I love the intimacy between Hume Cronyn and Leon Ames, just in all of their scenes. I love that they are working on a murder case and an attempted murder case, but all of their interactions are just another day in the life of being a lawyer. They're having this bet going on. They're always whispering and giving each other these one-liners. And I think it's so entertaining. People always bring up, oh, if there could be a spinoff movie or a spinoff show, I would have loved to see them have their own movie. I think that would have been very entertaining.
But to go back to what Drea was saying about Leon Ames, who plays the district attorney living down the road, he actually is the one who drives Frank to the Twin Oaks in the beginning of the movie, too, who effectively brings the plot together. I find that to be a bit shenanigans worthy.
Because only four people live in this town, and one of them's the cop. The
problem is that this movie plays a such a small town feel. But then you have this grander court case that plays out within it. I do want to throw out, too, Audrey Totter plays the girl who Frank seduces along the way after he and Cora get married. She plays Madge. She was supposed to have a bigger role and she didn't, for reasons unknown. I think she's really great in this movie too. And she has an equally salacious line in this movie where she's talking about something, the hot weather seat, and she has a thin skirt. And I'm just like, damn, these lines are gonna set the screen on fire.
Yeah, they definitely spent their time doing dialogue punch-ups and not smoothing out the narrative construction. That's my last burn. My last burn.
I think it's valid. I think it's very valid. But what was more important to audiences at the time is what you have to ask yourself.
So true. And this film stands up. There's a reason it was remade. And I'm honestly kind of shocked it wasn't again. Part of why I'm sure people would want to be remaking it on the actor's side is that as it is, this long sort of unwieldy shape gives them both sexy scenes, dramatic courtroom scenes, action shots. So there's a lot in there to enjoy. And it's an enjoyable view. It stood up and there's new fans all the time. And I'll probably watch it again someday. And once again, roll my eyes at that cat. That cat is smarter than everyone except for Hume Cronin.
When you think about it, John Garfield, after he did this, he made several movies after this, but this was the high point. This in like Body and Soul in 47. But then he also played the same character almost in something like Force of Evil in 48, which I just recently saw. And even something like The Breaking Point in 1950. I know Sam would bring up her favorite, which is He Ran All the Way, which is the last movie he made in 51.
Absolutely.
But I love how John Garfield always played guys that were incredibly sexual characters that were brought down by sex in any way, shape, or form. The Breaking Point is a great companion film to watch with this, with his relationship that he has with, I think it's Patricia Neal in that movie. And he's a guy who is married with children, who is always trying to sleep with his wife in that film. I was just like, dude, you need to let her have a life. I don't even think she leaves the house. I'm very concerned. But I think that that was to his advantage, that there's a lot of interesting stuff that plays out regarding domesticity in this movie, even though it is wrapped up within this really weird courtroom drama. I want to say that this almost pre-configures a world with like Peyton Place. What do we all think about this at the end? Do we recommend it? I'm going to say yes. I think it's got flaws. It is not the best noir that I've ever seen. It's not my favorite. But it does try to go in some unique directions. I think by the time the 50s showed up, the noir was very in the mold that it was in. And so it's always great to see a movie that tries to be something different. I have, again, not seen the remake. And I don't really have any interest in it. If the only difference is that there's sex in it, I think this movie works just fine without it. It's plenty hot, as we've talked about. But if you're interested in seeing what John Garfield is best known for, it's a must. But it is far from my favorite movie with him. I think it's far from my favorite movie where he's just horny for an hour and 45 minutes. There are other movies that I think encapsulate how awesome he is. This one's good, though. Him and Lana Turner are great. Drea brings up chemistry. They certainly had plenty of it, depending on what article you read that implies that they were having an affair either during production or before production. Drea, what do you think about this movie?
I would definitely recommend seeing it. I mean, it's a classic for a reason. And I think as much as I derive a certain amount of enjoyment for finding story holes or implausible character motivations, none of them are distracting. The heat of what they're doing and the performances are the best part of it. And I think it's nice to watch because of that. I think it has some twists and turns, some that work better than others. It's The Postman Always Wins Twice. I mean, who are we? Come on.
Sam, what about you?
I just know for a fact, I've watched this a million times. I'm going to watch it a million more times. I completely understand and agree with all of the plot holes. That's true. I mean, but it's true for a lot of the films of that time. And in this one, I agree, it's not too distracting. And you're really along for the ride with both of them. And you're really enraptured by both of their performances, really pulled in. Lana shines, John Garfield shines. If this is the only John Garfield movie that you see in your life, you're wrong. But you could do worse. I could not let this episode go without talking about the ending. This is one of my favorite endings in classic film. I know that's saying a lot. John Garfield is so genuine and heartfelt. He really sums up everything that he's gone through up until that point, and I just love it. It makes me cry every time. I rewatched this film today, and it made me cry again. If you're going to watch it for the ending and nothing else, that's great too. I think it's a great movie.
He sticks the landing.
He sticks the landing, very much so. I would agree with that.
Tell us your thoughts on John Garfield, The Postman Always Rings Twice, the fact that we talked about thirst way too often in this episode. You can email them to me at ticklishspace@gmail.com and we'll read them on the next episode. Once again, you have to follow my amazing co-host, Andrea. Where can fans find you online?
Online, I'm Twitter @TheDreaClark.
And Sam, where are you online?
I am running my blog, musingsofaclassicfilmaddict.com, and I'm @ClassicFilmGeek on Twitter. And every month you can find my Cooking with the Stars posts on ClassicMovieHub.com.
And you can listen to Ticklish Business a variety of different ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, Stitcher Radio, Player FM, Spotify, or iTunes. If you're listening via iTunes, consider helping us out by leaving a rating and a review. You can contact the show directly, once again, at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, @gmail.com. And you can visit me at my official website, where I talk classic film semi-regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. And the podcast is also on Twitter @ticklish_biz. If you want to learn more about upcoming episodes or get some exclusive merchandise, then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. We have a wealth of amazing perks. All your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the classic film podcast that it is. If you become a patron right now, we will be getting ready to send out the Ticklish Business buttons. We're still going back and forth on them. Turns out there's a typo. We spelled business wrong.
I spelled business wrong.
We're not pointing blame on anybody. I should have noticed that it was wrong. So my master's degree obviously is going to get revoked because I didn't catch it. But they look really good. I'm tempted to just give them to you guys and say, hey, you get a really rare limited edition button. We're going to be giving those out soon. If you are at the upcoming TCM Classic Film Festival, we're going to have special edition buttons that we made that are spelled right that we're going to be giving away exclusively to people who are at the film festival. So if you're a fan of the show, come up to us, let us know, and Sam and I will give you a button. You can also have access to my supplementary podcast I do with William Bibiani, based on a true podcast, and Adam Kautzer called Doubled Features. Scheduling's still been a bit prohibitive, but we're hoping to get those back up once I come back from South by Southwest in a couple of weeks. If you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. And if you want to learn more about the stars turning 100 in 2019, we're not talking about them on the show this year, but if you're a member of TCM Backlot, you can read my year-long series on the stars. In March, we're going to be talking about Jennifer Jones, which should be awesome. But next time, Drea, Sam, and I are going to be celebrating March Madness, talking about Frederick March. I'm going to throw this out here just already. I hate Frederick March.
Oh, no.
I have personal problems with Frederick March, which we can talk about that when we do the episode. But we are going to be looking at talking about 1931's Jekyll and Hyde with Frederick March and Miriam Hopkins. So it should be fun. Despite my personal antipathy for Freddie March. That'll be next episode, and we'll see you then.